This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, The Last Command by Timothy Zahn. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
Chapter 1.
Gliding through the blackness of deep space, the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera pointed its mighty arrowhead shape toward the dim star of its target system, 3,000ths of a light year away, and it prepared itself for war.
All systems show battle ready, Admiral,
the comm officer reported from the portside crew pit.
The task force is beginning to check in.
Very good, Lieutenant. Grand Admiral Thrawn nodded.
Inform me when all have done so.
Captain Pelion?
Sir?
Pelion said, searching his superior's face for the stress the Grand Admiral must be feeling. The stress he himself was certainly feeling. This was not just another tactical strike against the Rebellion, after all. Not a minor shipping raid, or even a complex but straightforward hit and fade against some insignificant planetary base. After nearly a month of frenzied preparations, Thrawn's master campaign for the Empire's final victory was about to be launched. But if the Grand Admiral was feeling any tension, he was keeping it to himself.
Begin the countdown, he told Pelion,
his voice as calm as if he were ordering dinner.
Yes, sir,
Pelion said, turning back to the group of one-quarter-size holographic figures standing before him in the Chimera's aft-bridge hologram pod.
Gentlemen, launch marks. Bellicose, 3 minutes.
Acknowledge, Chimera.
Captain Aben nodded, his proper military demeanor not quite masking his eagerness to take this war back to the Rebellion.
Good hunting.
The hollow image sputtered and vanished as the Bellicose raised its deflector shields, cutting off long-range communications. Pelion shifted his attention to the next image in line.
Relentless, 4.5 minutes.
Acknowledged,
Captain Dorja said, cupping his right fist in his left in an ancient Mershaff gesture of victory as he, too, vanished from the hologram pod. Pelion glanced at his datapad.
Judicator, 6 minutes.
We're ready, Chimera,
Captain Brandeis said, his voice soft. Soft and just a little bit wrong. Pelion frowned at him. Quarter-sized hollows didn't show a lot of detail, but even so, the expression on Brandeis' face was easy to read. It was the expression of a man out for blood.
This is war, Captain Brandeis, Thrawn said, coming up silently to Pelion's side. Not an opportunity for personal revenge.
I understand my duty, Admiral,
Brandeis said stiffly. Thrawn's blue-black eyebrows lifted slightly.
Do you, Captain? Do you indeed?
Slowly, reluctantly, some of the fire faded from Brandeis' face.
Yes, sir. My duty is to the Empire and to you, and to the ships and crews under my command.
Very good, Thrawn said. To the living, in other words, not to the dead.
Brandeis was still glowering, but he gave a dutiful nod.
Yes, sir.
Never forget that, Captain, Thrawn warned him. The fortunes of war rise and fall, and you may be assured that the Rebellion will be repaid in full for their destruction of the peremptory at the Katana fleet skirmish. But that repayment will occur in the context of our overall strategy, not as an act of private vengeance. His glowing red eyes narrowed slightly.
Certainly not by any fleet captain under my command. I trust I make myself clear.
Brandeis' cheek twitched. Pelion had never thought of the man as brilliant, but he was smart enough to recognize a threat when he heard one.
Very clear, Admiral.
Good. Thrawn eyed him a moment longer, then nodded.
I believe you've been given your launch mark.
Yes, sir. Judicator out.
Thrawn looked at Pelion.
Continue, Captain, he said, and turned away.
Yes, sir.
Pelion looked at his datapad.
Nemesis,
He finished the list without further incident. By the time the last hollow image disappeared, the final check-in from their own task force was complete.
The timetable appears to be running smoothly, Thrawn said, as Pelion returned to his command station. The Stormhawk reports that the guide freighters launched on time with tow cables functioning properly, and we've just intercepted a general emergency call from the Ando system.
The Bellicose and its task force right on schedule. Any response, sir?
Pelion asked.
The rebel base at Ord Padron acknowledged, Thrawn said. It should be interesting to see how much help they send.
Pelion nodded. The rebels had seen enough of Thrawn's tactics by now to expect Ando to be a feint, and to respond accordingly. But on the other hand, an attack force consisting of an Imperial Star Destroyer and 8 Katana Fleet dreadnoughts was hardly something they could afford to dismiss out of hand, either. Not that it really mattered. They would send a few ships to Ando to fight the Bellicose, and a few more to Filva to fight the Judicator, and a few more to Crondre to fight the Nemesis, and so on and so on. By the time the Death's Head hit the base itself, Ord Padron would be down to a skeleton defense, and screaming itself for all the reinforcements the Rebellion could scramble. And that was where those reinforcements would go, leaving the Empire's true target ripe for the picking. Pelion looked out the forward viewport at the star of the Yukio system dead ahead, his throat tightening as he contemplated again the enormous conceit of this whole plan. With planetary shields able to hold off all but the most massive turbolaser and proton torpedo bombardment, conventional wisdom held that the only way to subdue a modern world was to put a fast-moving ground force down at the edges and send them overland to destroy the shield generators. Between the fire laid down by the ground force and the subsequent orbital assault, the target world was always badly damaged by the time it was finally taken. The alternative, landing hundreds of thousands of troops in a major ground campaign that could stretch into months or years, was no better. To capture a planet relatively undamaged, but with shield generators still intact, was considered an impossibility. That bit of military wisdom would fall today, along with Yukio itself.
Intercept a distress signal from Filva, Admiral, the comm officer reported. Ord Padron again responding.
Good. Thrawn consulted his chrono. 7 minutes, I think, and we'll be able to move. His lips compressed just noticeably. I suppose we'd better confirm that our exalted Jedi Master is ready to do his part.
Pelion hid a grimace. Jarua Sabaoth, insane clone of the long-dead Jedi Master Joris Sabaoth, who a month ago had proclaimed himself the true heir to the Empire. He didn't like talking to the man any more than Thrawn did, but he might as well volunteer. If he didn't, it would simply become an order.
I'll go, sir, he said, standing up.
Thank you, Captain, Thrawn said,
as if Pelion would have had a choice. He felt the mental summons the moment he stepped beyond the force protection of the Isla Mari scattered about the bridge on their nutrient frames. Master Sabaoth clearly was impatient for the operation to begin, preparing himself as best he could. Fighting against Sabaoth's casual mental pressure to hurry, Pelion made his way down to Thrawn's command room. The chamber was brightly lit, in marked contrast to the subdued lighting the Grand Admiral usually preferred.
Captain Pelion!
Sabaoth called, beckoning to him from the double display ring in the center of the room.
Come in! I've been waiting for you.
The rest of the operation has taken my full attention,
Pelion told him stiffly, trying to hide his distaste for the man, knowing full well how futile such attempts were.
Of course,
Sabaoth smiled. A smile that showed more effectively than any words his amusement with Pelion's discomfort.
No matter. I take it Grand Admiral Thrawn is finally ready.
Almost, Pelion said. We want to clear out Ord Padron as much as possible before we move.
Sabaoth snorted.
You continue to assume the New Republic will dance to the Grand Admiral's tune.
They will,
Pelion said.
The Grand Admiral has studied the enemy thoroughly.
He studied their artwork,
Sabaoth countered with another snort.
That will be useful if the time ever comes when the New Republic has nothing but artists left to throw against us.
A signal from the display ring saved Pelion from the need to reply.
We're moving,
he told Sabaoth, starting a mental countdown of the 76 seconds it would take to reach the Yukio system from their position and trying not to let Sabaoth's words get under his skin. He didn't understand himself how Thrawn could so accurately learn the innermost secrets of a species from its artwork, but he'd seen that knowledge proved often enough to trust the Grand Admiral's instincts on such things. Sabaoth hadn't. But then Sabaoth wasn't really interested in an honest debate on the subject. For the past month, ever since declaring himself to be the true heir to the Emperor, Sabaoth had been pressing this quiet war against Thrawn's credibility, implying that true insight came only through the Force, and therefore only through him. Pelion himself didn't buy that argument. The Emperor had been deep into this Force thing, too, and he hadn't even been able to predict his own death at Endor. But the seeds of uncertainty Sabaoth was trying to sow were nevertheless starting to take hold, particularly among the less experienced of Thrawn's officers, which was, for Pelion, just one more reason why this attack had to succeed. The outcome hinged as much on Thrawn's reading of the Yukian cultural ethos as it did on straight military tactics, on Thrawn's conviction that at a basic psychological level, the Yukians were terrified of the impossible.
He will not always be right,
Sabaoth said into Pelion's musings. Pelion bit down hard on the inside of his cheek, the skin of his back crawling at having had his thoughts so casually invaded.
You don't have any concept of privacy, do you?
He growled.
I am the Empire, Captain Pelion,
Sabaoth said, his eyes glowing with a dark, fanatical fire.
Your thoughts are a part of your service to me.
My service is to Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Pelion said stiffly. Sabaoth smiled.
You may believe that if you wish, but to business, true Imperial business. When the battle here is over, Captain Pelion, I want a message sent to Wayland.
Announcing your imminent return, no doubt,
Pelion said sourly. Sabaoth had been insisting for nearly a month now that he would soon be going back to his former home on Wayland, where he would take command of the cloning facility in the Emperor's old storehouse inside Mount Tantis. So far he'd been too busy trying to subvert Thrawn's position to do anything more than talk about it.
Do not worry, Captain Pelion,
Sabaoth said, all amused again.
When the time is right, I will indeed return to Wayland, which is why you will contact Wayland after this battle is over, and order them to create a clone for me. A very special clone.
Grand Admiral Thrawn will have to authorize that,
were the words that came to mind.
What kind do you want?
Were the ones that inexplicably came out. Pelion blinked, running the memory over in his mind again. Yes, that was what he'd said, all right. Sabaoth smiled again at his silent confusion.
I merely wish a servant,
he said.
Someone who will be waiting there for me when I return, formed from one of the Emperor's prize souvenirs. Sample B-2332-54, I believe it was. You will, of course, impress upon the garrison commander there that this must be done in total secrecy.
I will do nothing of the sort,
he thought.
Yes,
Pelion heard himself say instead. The sound of the word shocked him, but certainly he didn't mean it. On the contrary, as soon as the battle was over, he'd be reporting this little incident directly to Thrawn.
You will also keep this conversation a private matter between ourselves,
Sabaoth said lazily.
Once you have obeyed, you will forget it even happened.
Of course,
Pelion nodded, just to shut him up. Yes, he'd report this to Thrawn, all right. The Grand Admiral would know what to do. The countdown reached zero, and on the main wall display, the planet Yukio appeared.
We should put up a tactical display, Master Sabaoth,
he said. Sabaoth waved a hand.
As you wish.
Pelion reached over the double display ring and touched the proper key, and in the center of the room, the holographic tactical display appeared. The Chimera was driving toward high orbit above the sunside equator. The 10 Katana Fleet dreadnoughts of its task force were splitting up into outer and inner defense positions, and the Stormhawk was coming in as backstop from the night side. Other ships, mostly freighters and other commercial types, could be seen dropping through the brief gaps ground control was opening for them in Yukio's energy shield, a hazy blue shell surrounding the planet about 50 kilometers above the surface. Two of the blips flashed red. The guide freighters from the Stormhawk, looking as innocent as all the rest of the ships scurrying madly for cover. The freighters and the four invisible companions they towed.
Invisible only to those without eyes to see them,
Sabaoth murmured.
So now you can see the ships themselves, can you?
Pelion growled.
How Jedi skills grow.
He'd been hoping to irritate Sabaoth a little. Not much, just a little. But it was a futile effort.
I can see the men inside your precious cloaking shields,
the Jedi Master said placidly.
I can see their thoughts and guide their wills. What does the metal itself matter?
Pelion felt his lip twist.
I suppose there's a lot that doesn't matter to you,
he said. From the corner of his eye, he saw Sabaoth smile.
What doesn't matter to a Jedi Master does not matter to the universe.
The freighters and cloaked cruisers were nearly to the shield now.
They'll be dropping the tow cables as soon as they're inside the shield,
Pelion reminded Sabaoth.
Are you ready?
The Jedi Master straightened up in his seat and closed his eyes to slits.
I await the Grand Admiral's command,
he said sardonically. For another second, Pelion looked at the other's composed expression, a shiver running up through him. He could remember vividly the first time Sabaoth had tried this kind of direct long-distance control. Could remember the pain that had been on Sabaoth's face, the pinched look of concentration and agony as he struggled to hold the mental contacts. Barely 2 months ago, Thrawn had confidently said that Sabaoth would never be a threat to the Empire, because he lacked the ability to focus and concentrate his Jedi power on a long-term basis. Somehow, between that time and now, Sabaoth had obviously succeeded in learning the necessary control, which left Sabaoth as a threat to the Empire. A very dangerous threat indeed. The intercom beeped.
Captain Pelion!
Pelion reached over the display ring and touched the key, pushing away his fears about Sabaoth as best he could. For the moment, at least, the fleet needed Sabaoth. Fortunately, perhaps, Sabaoth also needed the fleet.
We're ready, Admiral,
he said.
Stand by,
Thrawn said.
Two cables detaching now.
They are free. They are under power, moving now to their appointed positions.
Confirm that they're beneath the planetary shield.
For the first time, a hint of the old strain crossed Sabaoth's face. Hardly surprising. With a cloaking shield preventing the Chimera from seeing the cruisers, and at the same time blinding the cruiser's own sensors, the only way to know exactly where they were was for Sabaoth to do a precise location check on the mines he was touching.
All four ships are beneath the shield,
he said.
Be absolutely certain, Jedi Master. If you're wrong...
I am not wrong, Grand Admiral Thrawn. I will do my part in this battle. Concern yourself with yours.
For a moment, the intercom was silent. Pelion winced, visualizing the Grand Admiral's expression.
Very well, Jedi Master. Prepare to do your part.
There was the double click of an opening comm channel.
This is the Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera, calling the Overliege of Yukio,
Thrawn said.
In the name of the Empire, I declare the Yukian system to be once again under the mandate of Imperial law and the protection of Imperial forces. You will lower your shields, recall all military units to their bases, and prepare for an orderly transfer of command.
There was no response.
I know you're receiving this message. If you fail to respond, I will have to assume that you mean to resist the Empire's offer. In that event, I would have no choice but to open hostilities.
Again, silence.
They're sending another transmission,
Pelion heard the comm officer say.
Sounds a little more panicked than the first one was. I'm certain the third will be even more so,
Thrawn told him.
Prepare for firing sequence one, Master Sabaoth.
The cruisers are ready, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Sabaoth said.
As am I.
Be sure that you are,
Thrawn said, quietly threatening.
Unless the timing is absolutely perfect, this entire show will be worse than useless. Turbo laser battery 3, stand by firing sequence 1 on my mark. 3, 2, 1, fire.
On the tactical hologram, a double lance of green fire angled out from the Chimera's turbolaser batteries toward the planet below. The blast struck the hazy blue of the planetary shield, splashed light as their energy was defocused and reflected back into space. And with the desired perfect timing, the two cloaked cruisers hovering on repulsor lips beneath the shield at those two points fired in turn. Their turbolaser blasts sizzling through the atmosphere into two of Yukio's major air defense bases. That was what Pelion saw. The Yukians, with no way of knowing about the cloaked cruisers, would have seen the Chimera fire two devastating shots cleanly through an impenetrable planetary shield.
Third transmission cut off right in the middle, sir,
the comm officer reported with a touch of dark humor.
I think we surprised them. Let's convince them it wasn't a fluke,
Thrawn said.
Prepare firing sequence 2, Master Sabaoth.
The cruisers are ready.
Turbo laser battery 2, stand by firing sequence 2 on my mark. 3, 2, 1, fire.
Again, the green fire lanced out. And again, with perfect timing, the cloaked cruisers created their illusion.
Well done,
Thrawn said.
Master Sabaoth, move the cruisers into position for sequences 3 and 4.
As you command, Grand Admiral Thrawn.
Unconsciously, Pelion braced himself. Sequence 4 had two of the Yukian's 30 overlapping shield generators as its targets. Launching such an attack would mean that Thrawn had given up on his stated goal of taking Yukio with its planetary defenses intact.
Imperial Star Destroyer Chimera! This is Tol Dosala of the Yukian Overliege.
A slightly quavering voice came from the intercom speaker.
We would ask you to cease your bombardment of Yukio while we discuss terms for surrender.
My terms are quite simple. You will begin by lowering your planetary shield and allowing my forces to land. They will be given control of the shield generators themselves and of all ground-to-space weaponry. All fighting vehicles larger than command speeders will be moved to designated military bases and turned over to Imperial control. Though you will, of course, be ultimately answerable to the Empire, your political and social systems will remain under your control, provided your people behave themselves, of course.
And once these changes have been implemented?
Then you'll be part of the Empire, with all the rights and duties that implies.
There will be no war-level tax levies. No forced conscription of our young people.
Pelion could imagine Thrawn's grim smile. No, the Empire would never need to bother with forced conscription again. Not with the Emperor's collection of Spa-Arti cloning cylinders in their hands.
No to your second question. A qualified no to your first. As you are obviously aware, most Imperial worlds are currently under war status taxation levels. However, there are exceptions, and it is likely that your share of the war effort will come directly from your extensive food production and processing facilities.
There was a long pause from the other end. Dosala was no fool, Pelion realized. The Yukian knew full well what Thrawn had in mind for his world. First, it would be direct Imperial control of the ground space defenses, then direct control of the food distribution system, the processing facilities, and the vast farming and livestock grazing regions themselves. And in a very short time, the entire planet would have become nothing more than a supply depot for the Imperial war machine. But the alternative was for him to stand silently by and watch as his world was utterly and impossibly demolished before his eyes. And he knew that, too.
"We will lower the planetary shields, Chimera, as a gesture of good faith,"
Dulcela said at last, his tone defiant, but with a hint of defeat to it.
"But before the generators and ground space weaponry can be turned over to Imperial forces, we shall require certain guarantees regarding the safety of the Yukian people and our land."
"Certainly,"
Thrawn said, without any trace of gloating that most Imperial commanders would have indulged in at this point. A small act of courtesy that Pelion knew was as precisely calculated as the rest of the attack had been. Permitting the Yukian leaders to surrender with their dignity intact would slow down the inevitable resistance to Imperial rule until it was too late.
"A representative will be on his way shortly to discuss the particulars with your government. Meanwhile, I presume you have no objection to our forces taking up preliminary defense positions."
A sigh, more felt than really heard.
"We have no objection, Chimera. We are lowering the shield now."
On the tactical display, the blue haze surrounding the planet faded away.
"Master Sabaoth, have the cruisers moved to polar positions. We don't want any of the dropships blundering into them. General Covell, you may begin transporting your forces to the surface. Standard defensive positions around all targets." "Acknowledged, Admiral,"
Covell's voice said, a little too dryly, and Pelion felt a tight smile twitch at his lip. It had only been 2 weeks since the top fleet and army commanders had been let in on the secret of the Mount Tantus cloning project, and Covell was one of those who still hadn't adjusted completely to the idea. Though the fact that three of the companies he was about to lead down to the surface were composed entirely of clones might have had something to do with his skepticism. On the tactical hologram, the first waves of dropships and TIE fighter escorts had exited the Chimera and Stormhawk, fanning out toward their assigned targets. Clones in dropships, about to carry out Imperial orders, as the clone crews and the cloaked cruisers had already done so well. Pelion frowned, an odd and uncomfortable thought suddenly striking him. Had Sabaoth been able to guide the cruisers so well because each of their 1,000-man crews were composed of variants on just 20 or so different minds? Or, even more disturbing, could part of the Jedi Master's split-second control have been due to the fact that Sabaoth was himself a clone? And either way, did that mean that the Mount Tantus project was playing directly into Sabaoth's hands in his bid for power? Perhaps. One more question he would have to bring to Thrawn's attention. Pelion looked down at Sabaoth, belatedly remembering that in the Jedi Master's presence, such thoughts were not his private property. But Sabaoth wasn't looking at him, knowingly or otherwise. He was staring straight ahead, his eyes unfocused, the skin of his face taut, a faint smile just beginning to crease his lips.
"Master Sabaoth?"
"There, there,"
Sabaoth whispered, his voice deep and husky.
"There, there,"
he repeated, louder this time. Pelion frowned back at the tactical hologram.
"Who's where?"
he asked.
"There at Filva,"
Sabaoth said. Abruptly he looked up at Pelion, his eyes bright and insane.
"My Jedi are at Filva."
"Master Sabaoth, confirm that the cruisers have moved to polar positions,"
Thrawn's voice came sharply.
"Then report on the feint battles."
"My Jedi are at Filva."
Sabaoth cut him off.
What do I care about your battles?
Sabaoth!
With a wave of his hand, Sabaoth shut off the intercom.
Now, Leia Organa Solo, you are mine.
The Millennium Falcon twisted hard to starboard as a TIE fighter shot past overhead, lasers blazing away madly as it tried unsuccessfully to track the freighter's maneuver. Clenching her teeth firmly against the movement, Leia Organa Solo watched as one of their escort X-Wings blew the Imperial Starfighter into a cloud of flaming dust. The sky spun around the Falcon's canopy as the ship rolled back toward its original heading.
Look out!
3PO wailed from the seat behind Leia as another TIE fighter roared in toward them from the side. The warning was unnecessary. With deceptive ungainliness, the Falcon was already corkscrewing back the other direction to bring its ventral quad laser battery to bear. Faintly audible, even through the cockpit door, Leia heard the sound of a Wookiee battle roar, and the TIE fighter went the way of its late partner.
Good shot, Chewie,
Han Solo called into the intercom as he got the Falcon leveled again.
Wedge?
Still with you, Falcon.
Wedge Antilles' voice came promptly.
We're clear for now. But there's another wave of TIE fighters on the way.
Yeah.
Han glanced at Leia.
It's your call, sweetheart. You still want to try and reach ground?
3PO gave a little electronic gasp.
Surely, Captain Solo, you aren't suggesting...
Put a choke valve on it, Goldenrod.
Han cut him off.
Leia?
Leia looked out the cockpit canopy at the Imperial Star Destroyer and eight dreadnoughts arrayed against the beleaguered planet ahead. Clustering around it like Minox around an unshielded power generator. It was to have been her last diplomatic mission before settling in to await the birth of her twins. A quick trip to calm a nervous Fylvian government and demonstrate the New Republic's determination to protect the systems in this sector. Some demonstration.
There's no way we can make it through all that,
she told Han reluctantly.
Even if we could, I doubt the Fylvians would risk opening the shield to let us in. We'd better make a run for it.
Sounds good to me,
Han grunted.
Wedge, we're pulling out. Stay with us.
Copy, Falcon,
Wedge said.
You'll have to give us a few minutes to calculate the jump back.
Don't bother,
Han said, swiveling around in his seat to key in the nav computer.
We'll feed you the numbers from here.
Copy. Rogue Squadron, screen formation.
You know, I'm starting to get tired of this.
Han told Leia, swiveling back to face front.
I thought you said your Nogri pals were going to leave you alone.
This has nothing to do with the Nogri.
Leia shook her head, an odd half-felt tension stretching at her forehead. Was it her imagination? Or were the Imperial ships surrounding Filva starting to break formation?
This is Grand Admiral Thrawn playing with his new Dark Force dreadnoughts.
Yeah,
Han agreed quietly. And Leia winced at the momentary flash of bitterness in his sense. Despite everyone's best efforts to persuade him otherwise, Han still considered it his own personal fault that Thrawn had gotten to the derelict Katana fleet ships, the so-called Dark Force, ahead of the New Republic.
I wouldn't have thought he could get them reconditioned this fast,
Han added, as he twisted the Falcon's nose away from Filva and back toward deep space. Leia swallowed.
The strange tension was still there, like a distant malevolence pressing against the edges of her mind. Maybe he has enough Spa-Arty cylinders to clone some engineers and techs as well as soldiers.
That's sure a fun thought,
Han said, and through her tension, Leia could sense his sudden change in mood as he tapped the comm switch.
Wedge, take a look back at Filva and tell me if I'm seeing things.
Over the comm, Leia could hear Wedge's thoughtful intake of air.
You mean like the whole Imperial force breaking off their attack and coming after us?
Yeah, that.
Looks real enough to me. Could be a good time to get out of here.
Yeah,
Han said slowly.
Maybe.
Leia frowned at her husband. There'd been something in his voice.
Han?
The Fylvians would have called for help before they put up their shield, right?
Han asked, forehead furrowed with thought.
Right,
Leia agreed cautiously.
And the nearest New Republic base is Ord Pardrin, right?
Right.
Okay. Rogue Squadron, we're changing course to starboard. Stay with me.
He keyed his board, and the Falcon started a sharp curve to the right.
Watch it, Falcon. This is taking us back toward the TIE fighter group.
We're not going that far,
Han assured him.
Here's our vector.
He straightened out the ship onto their new course heading and threw a look at the rear display.
Good. They're still chasing us.
Behind him, the nav computer beeped its notification that the jump coordinates were ready.
Wedge, we've got your coordinates,
Leia said, reaching for the data transmission key.
Hold it, Falcon,
Wedge cut her off.
We've got company to starboard.
Leia looked that direction, her throat tightening as she saw what Wedge meant. The approaching TIE fighters were coming up fast, and already were close enough to eavesdrop on any transmission the Falcon tried to make to its escort. Sending Wedge the jump coordinates now would be an open invitation for the Imperials to have a reception committee waiting at the other end.
Perhaps I can be of assistance, Your Highness. As you know, I am fluent in over 6 billion forms of communication. I could transmit the coordinates to Commander Antilles in Fortis, or Valkyrie Trade Language, for example.
And then you'd send them the translation?
Han put in dryly.
Of course. Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, don't worry about it,
Han said.
Wedge, you were at Zikwane 2 years ago, weren't you?
Yes. A crack and twist?
Right. On two. One, two.
Outside the canopy, Leia caught a glimpse of the X-Wing swinging into a complicated new escort formation around the Falcon.
What is this by us?
She asked.
Our way out,
Han told her, checking the rear display again.
Pull the coordinates, add a two to the second number of each one, and then send the whole package to the X-Wings.
I see.
Leia nodded her understanding as she got to work. Altering the second digit wouldn't change the appearance of their exit vector enough for the Imperials to catch on to the trick, but it would be more than enough to put any chase force a couple of light years off target.
Clever. And that little flight maneuver they did just now was just window dressing?
Right. Makes anyone watching think that's all there is to it. A little something Pash Kraken came up with at that fiasco off Zikwane.
Han glanced at the rear display again.
I think we've got enough lead to outrun them, he said. Let's try.
We're not jumping to light speed?
Leia frowned, an old and rather painful memory floating up from the back of her mind. That mad scramble away from Hoth, with Darth Vader's whole fleet breathing down their necks, and a hyperdrive that turned out to be broken. Han threw her a sideways look.
Don't worry, sweetheart. The hyperdrive's working fine today.
Let's hope so, Leia murmured.
See, as long as they're chasing us, they can't bother Filva, Han went on. And the farther we draw them away, the longer the backup force will have to get here from Ord Pardrin.
The brilliant green flash of a near miss cut off Leia's intended response.
I think we've given them all the time we can,
she told Han. Within her, she could sense the turmoil coming from her unborn twins.
Can we please get out of here?
A second bolt spattered off the Falcon's upper deflector shield.
Yeah, I think you're right, Han agreed. Wedge, you ready to leave this party?
Whenever you are, Falcon. Go ahead. We'll follow when you're clear.
Right.
Reaching over, Han gripped the hyperdrive levers and pulled them gently back. Through the cockpit canopy, the stars stretched themselves into star lines, and they were safe. Leia took a deep breath, let it out slowly. Within her, she could still sense the twins' anxiety, and for a moment, she turned her mind to the job of calming them down. It was a strange sensation, she'd often thought, touching minds that dealt in emotion and pure sensation instead of pictures and words. So different from the minds of Han and Luke and her other friends. So different, too, from the distant mind that had been orchestrating that Imperial attack force. Behind her, the door slid open, and Chewbacca came into the cockpit.
Good shooting, Chewie,
Han told the Wookiee as he heaved his massive bulk into the portside passenger seat beside 3PO.
You have any more trouble with the horizontal control arm?
Chewbacca rumbled a negative, his dark eyes studying Leia's face. He growled her a question.
I'm all right,
Leia assured him, blinking back sudden and inexplicable tears.
really. She looked at Han, to find him frowning at her, too.
You weren't worried, were you?
He asked.
It was just an Imperial task force. Nothing to get excited about.
She shook her head.
It wasn't that, Han. There was something else back there. A kind of...
She shook her head again.
I don't know.
Perhaps it was similar to your indisposition at Endor. You remember, when you collapsed while Chewbacca and I were repairing the...
Chewbacca rumbled a warning, and the droid abruptly shut up. But far too late.
No, let him talk,
Han said, his sense going all protectively suspicious as he looked at Leia.
What indisposition was this?
There wasn't anything to it, Han,
Leia assured him, reaching over to take his hand.
On our first orbit around Endor, we passed through the spot where the Death Star blew up. For a few seconds, I could feel something like the Emperor's presence around me. That's all.
Oh, that's all,
Han said sarcastically, throwing a brief glare back at Chewbacca.
A dead Emperor tries to make a grab for you, and you don't think it's worth mentioning?
Now you're being silly, Leia chided. There was nothing to worry about. It was over quickly, and there weren't any after effects. Really. Anyway, what I felt back at Filva was completely different.
Glad to hear it,
Han said, not yet ready to let it go.
Did you have any of the med people check you over or anything after you got back?
Well, there really wasn't any time before...
Fine. You do it as soon as we're back.
Leia nodded with a quiet sigh. She knew that tone, and it wasn't something she could wholeheartedly argue against anyway.
All right. If I can find time...
You'll make time,
Han countered.
Or I'll have Luke lock you in the med center when he gets back. I mean it, sweetheart.
Leia squeezed his hand, feeling a similar squeeze on her heart as she did so. Luke, off alone in Imperial territory.
But he was all right. He had to be. All right,
she told Han.
I'll get checked out. I promise.
Good,
he said, his eyes searching her face.
So what was it you felt back at Filva?
I don't know,
she hesitated.
Maybe it was the same thing Luke felt on the Katana. You know, when the Imperials put that landing party of clones aboard?
Yeah,
Han agreed doubtfully.
Maybe. Those dreadnoughts were awfully far away.
There were probably a lot more clones, though, too.
Yeah, maybe,
Han said again.
Well, I suppose Chewie and me had better get to work on that ion flux stabilizer before it quits on us completely. Can you handle things up here okay, sweetheart?
I'm fine,
Leia assured him, just as glad to be leaving this line of conversation.
You two go ahead.
Because the other possibility was one she'd just as soon not think about right now. The Emperor, it had long been rumored, had had the ability to use the Force to exercise direct control over his military forces. If the Jedi Master Luke had confronted on Jomark had that same ability... Reaching down, she caressed her belly and focused on the pair of tiny minds within her. No, it was indeed not something she wanted to think about.
I presume, Thrawn said in that deadly calm voice of his, that you have some sort of explanation.
Slowly, deliberately, Sabaoth lifted his head from the command room's double display circle to look at the Grand Admiral. At the Grand Admiral, and with undisguised contempt, at the Islamir on his nutrient frame slung across Thrawn's shoulders.
Do you likewise have an explanation, Grand Admiral Thrawn?
He demanded. You broke off the diversionary attack on Filva, Thrawn said, ignoring Sabaoth's question. You then proceeded to send the entire task force on a dead-end chase.
And you, Grand Admiral Thrawn, have failed to bring my Jedi to me,
Sabaoth countered. His voice, Pelion noticed uneasily, was slowly rising in both pitch and volume.
You, your tame Nogri, your entire empire, All of you have failed!
Thrawn's glowing red eyes narrowed.
Indeed. And was it also our failure that you were unable to hold on to Luke Skywalker after we delivered him to you on Jomark?
You did not deliver him to me, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Sabaoth insisted.
I summoned him there, through the Force!
It was Imperial Intelligence who planted the rumor that Joris Sabaoth had returned and been seen on Jomark,
Thrawn cut him off coldly.
It was Imperial Transport who brought you there, Imperial Supply who arranged and provisioned that house for you, and Imperial Engineering who built the camouflaged island landing site for your use. The Empire did its part to get Skywalker into your hands. It was you who failed to keep him there.
No!
Sabaoth snapped.
Skywalker left Jomark because Mara Jade escaped from you and twisted his mind against me. She will pay for that. You hear me? She shall pay!
For a long moment, Thrawn was silent.
You threw the entire Filva task force against the Millennium Falcon,
he said at last, his voice under control again.
Did you succeed in capturing Leia Organa Solo?
No,
Sabaoth growled.
But not because she didn't want to come to me. She does. Just as Skywalker does.
Thrawn threw a glance at Pelion.
She wants to come to you,
he asked. Sabaoth smiled.
Very much,
he said, his voice unexpectedly losing all its anger, becoming almost dreamy.
She wants me to teach her children,
he continued, his eyes drifting around the command room.
To instruct them in the ways of the Jedi. To create them in my own image. Because I am the master. The only one there is.
He looked back at Thrawn.
You must bring her to me, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
he said, his manner somewhere halfway between solemn and pleading.
We must free her from her entrapment among those who fear her powers. They'll destroy her if we don't.
Of course we must, Thrawn said soothingly.
But you must leave that task to me. All I need is a little more time.
Sabaoth frowned with thought, his hand slipping up beneath his beard to finger the medallion hanging on its neck chain, and Pelion felt a shiver run up his back. No matter how many times he saw it happen, he would never get used to these sudden dips into the slippery twilight of clone madness. It had, he knew, been a universal problem with the early cloning experiments, a permanent mental and emotional instability, inversely scaled to the length of the duplicate's growth cycle. Few of the scientific papers on the subject had survived the Clone Wars era, but Pelion had come across one that had suggested that no clone grown to maturity in less than a year would be stable enough to survive outside of a totally controlled environment. Given the destruction they'd unleashed on the galaxy, Pelion had always assumed that the clone masters had eventually found at least a partial solution to the problem. Whether they had recognized the underlying cause of the madness was another question entirely. It could very well be that Thrawn was the first to truly understand it.
Very well, Grand Admiral Thrawn,
Sabaoth said abruptly.
You may have one final chance, but I warn you, it will be your last. After that, I will take the matter into my own hands.
Beneath the bushy eyebrows, his eyes flashed.
And I warn you further. If you cannot accomplish even so small a task, perhaps I will deem you unworthy to lead the military forces of my empire.
Thrawn's eyes glittered, but he merely inclined his head slightly.
I accept your challenge, Master Sabaoth.
Good.
Deliberately, Sabaoth resettled himself into his seat, and closed his eyes.
You may leave me now, Grand Admiral Thrawn. I wish to meditate, and to plan for the future of my Jedi.
For a moment, Thrawn stood silently, his glowing red eyes gazing unblinkingly at Sabaoth. Then he shifted his gaze to Pelion.
"You'll accompany me to the bridge, Captain," he said. "I want you to oversee the defense arrangements for the Yukio system."
"Yes, sir,"
Pelion said, glad of any excuse to get away from Sabaoth. For a moment he paused, feeling a frown cross his face as he looked down at Sabaoth. Had there been something he had wanted to bring to Thrawn's attention? He was almost certain there was. Something having to do with Sabaoth and clones and the Mount Tantus project? But the thought wouldn't come, and with a mental shrug, he pushed the question aside. It would surely come to him in time. Stepping around the display ring, he followed his commander from the room.
Chapter 2.
It was called the Kalaya's Sage Liyue, the city of glowing crystal of Burchest. And it had been one of the most spectacular wonders of the galaxy since the earliest days of the Old Republic. The entire city was nothing more or less than a single gigantic crystal, created over the eons by saltile spray from the dark red-orange waters of the Lefari Sea that roiled up against the low bluff upon which it rested. The original city had been painstakingly sculpted from the crystal over decades by local Burchestian artisans, whose descendants continued to guide and nurture its slow growth. At the height of the Old Republic, Kalaya's had been a major tourist attraction, its populace making a comfortable living from the millions of beings who flocked to the stunning beauty of the city and its surroundings. But the chaos of the Clone Wars and the subsequent rise of the Empire had taken a severe toll on such idle amusements, and Kalaya's had been forced to turn to other means for its support. Fortunately, the tourist trade had left a legacy of well-established trade routes between Burchest and most of the galaxy's major systems. The obvious solution was for the Burchestians to promote Kalaya's as a trade center, and while the city was hardly to the level yet of Sfivrin or Kataris, they had achieved a modest degree of success. The only problem was that it was a trade center on the Imperial side of the line. A squad of stormtroopers strode down the crowded street, their white armor taking on a colored tinge from the angular red-orange buildings around them. Taking a long step out of their way, Luke Skywalker pulled his hood a bit closer around his face. He could sense no particular alertness from the squad, but this deep into Imperial space, there was no reason to take chances. The stormtroopers strode past without so much as a glance in his direction, and with a quiet sigh of relief, Luke returned his attention to his contemplation of the city. Between the stormtroopers, the Imperial fleet crewers on layover between flights, and the smugglers poking around hoping to pick up jobs, the darkly businesslike sense of the city was in strange and pointed contrast to its serene beauty. And somewhere in all that serene beauty was something far more dangerous than mere Imperial stormtroopers. A group of clones. Or so New Republic intelligence thought. Painstakingly sifting through thousands of intercepted Imperial communiques, they tentatively pinpointed Kalaya's and the Burchest system as one of the transfer points in the new flood of human duplicates beginning to man the ships and troop carriers of Grand Admiral Thrawn's war machine. That flood had to be stopped, and quickly, which meant finding the location of the cloning tanks and destroying them, which first meant backtracking the traffic pattern from a known transfer point, which first meant confirming that clones were indeed coming through Kalaya's. A group of men dressed in the dull bands and robes of Sfivreni traders came around a corner two blocks ahead, and as he had so many times in the past 2 days, Luke reached out toward them with the Force. One quick check was all it took. The traders did not have the strange aura he'd detected in the boarding party of clones that had attacked them aboard the Katana. But even as he withdrew his consciousness, something else caught Luke's attention. Something he had almost missed amid the torrent of human and alien thoughts and sensations that swirled together around him like bits of colored glass in a sandstorm. A coolly calculating mind, one which Luke felt certain he'd encountered before,
but couldn't quite identify through the haze of mental noise between them. And the owner of that mind was in turn fully aware of Luke's presence in Callias, and was watching him. Luke grimaced. Alone in enemy territory, with his transport 2 kilometers away at the Callias landing field, and his only weapon a lightsaber that would identify him the minute he drew it from his tunic, he was not exactly holding the high ground here. But he had the Force, and he knew his follower was there. All in all, it gave him fair odds. A couple of meters to his left was the entrance to the long arched tunnel of a pedestrian bridgeway. Turning down it, Luke stepped up his pace, trying to remember from his study of the city maps exactly where this particular bridge went. Across the city's icy river, he decided, and up toward the taller and higher class regions overlooking the sea itself. Behind him, he sensed his pursuer follow him into the bridgeway. And as Luke put distance between himself and the mental din of the crowded market regions behind him, he was finally able to identify the man. It was not as bad as he'd feared, but potentially, at least, it was bad enough. With a sigh, Luke stopped and waited. The bridgeway, with its gentle curve hiding both ends from view, was as good a place as any for a confrontation. His pursuer came to the last part of the curve. Then, as if anticipating that his quarry would be waiting there, he stopped just out of sight. Luke extended his senses, caught the sound of a blaster being drawn.
"It's all right," he called softly. "We're alone. Come on out."
There was a brief hesitation, and Luke caught the momentary flicker of surprise. And then, Talon Card stepped into sight.
"I see the universe hasn't run out of ways to surprise me," the smuggler commented, inclining his head to Luke in an abbreviated bow as he slid his blaster back into its holster. "From the way you were acting, I thought you were probably a spy from the New Republic. But I have to admit, you're the last person I would have expected them to send."
Luke eyed him, trying hard to read the sense of the man. The last time he'd seen Card, just after the battle for the Katana, the other had emphasized that he and his smuggling group intended to remain neutral in this war.
"And what were you going to do after you knew for sure?"
"I hadn't planned on turning you in, if that's what you mean," Card said, throwing a glance behind him down the bridgeway. "If it's all the same to you, I'd like to move on. Burchestians don't normally hold extended conversations in bridgeways, and the tunnel can carry voices a surprising distance."
And if there was an ambush waiting for them at the other end of the bridgeway? But if there were, Luke would know before they reached it.
"Fine with me," he said, stepping to the side and gesturing Card forward.
The other favored him with a sardonic smile.
"You don't trust me, do you?"
he said, brushing past Luke and heading down the bridgeway.
"Must be Han's influence,"
Luke said apologetically, falling into step beside him.
"His or yours, or maybe Mara's."
He caught the shift in Card's sense, a quick flash of concern that was as quickly buried again.
"Speaking of Mara, how is she?"
"Nearly recovered,"
Luke assured him.
"The medics tell me that repairing that kind of light neural damage isn't difficult, just time-consuming."
Card nodded, his eyes on the tunnel ahead.
"I appreciate your taking care of her," he said, almost grudgingly. "Our own medical facilities wouldn't have been up to the task."
Luke waved the thanks away.
"It was the least we could do after the help you gave us at the Katana."
"Perhaps."
They reached the end of the bridgeway and stepped out into a street considerably less crowded than the one they'd left. Above and ahead of them, the 3 intricately carved government headquarter towers that faced the sea could be seen above the nearby buildings. Reaching out with the Force, Luke did a quick reading of the people passing by. Nothing.
"You heading anywhere in particular?"
he asked Card. The other shook his head.
"Wandering the city," he said casually. "You?"
"The same,"
Luke said, trying to match the other's tone.
"And hoping to see a familiar face or 2, or 3, or 4, or 5.
So Card knew, or had guessed, why he was here.
Somehow that didn't really surprise him.
If they're here to be seen, I'll find them, he said. I don't suppose you have any...